which is, of course, him killing Goliath. Yay! We like that story, right? Yeah, it's an inspiring story. So, yes, we're in 1 Samuel 17 today. I'll open with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God, we ask for your presence to be here with us today. That we will be opened our hearts and eyes and ears to you. That will keep our minds always malleable to your ways, to your knowledge, to your wisdom. God, we ask you will keep us dear to your heart as we keep you to ours. God, we praise you and glorify you for this chance to come before you and to worship and to study. We ask your presence and your blessing. In the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
1 Samuel chapter 17. Now the Philistines were gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soco, which belongs to Judah. And they camped between Soco and Azekah in Aphaz Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines, named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs, and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine, and you, servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become his servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us." Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Then Saul and all Israel heard these words from the Philistine. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of the Ephraimite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul into the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went into battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and second to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. Now the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock in Bethlehem. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. Then Jesse said to David, his son, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp of your brothers. Bring also these ten cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them." So Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was walking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who's coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" The people answered him in accord with his word, saying, "Thus it will be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, the oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." But David said, "What have I done now? Was it not just a question?" Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing. And the people answered the same thing as before. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." Then Saul said to David, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me and from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even his pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Then the Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you have come out when you with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by word nor by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Then it happened, when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward him, toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sunk into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword, drew it out of its sheath and killed him, and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way from Shaarayim even to Gath and Ekron. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner said, "By your life, O king, I do not know." The king said, "You inquire whose son this youth is." So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite."
Thank you, Jeff, for reading 1 Samuel 17. Of course, it's always an inspiring story. A little gory, but that always makes them fun. Are there any comments or questions regarding this particular chapter? Tammy.
How could Saul forget his own harpist?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. It's a rather unique scenario, which I think is what's occurring in this particular chapter. There's actually a number of possibilities as to how that could happen. We'll be discussing a few of them shortly. How Saul could forget his harpist, forget the man who plays before him to make him feel better during the days. Yes, Hector?
No. I mentioned it really quickly, but he did say he took Goliath's head to Jerusalem?
Yes.
Okay.
Eventually, it makes it to Jerusalem, not immediately. He kind of carries the trophy for a while. Which, I mean, what young man wouldn't say, "Hey, look what I did. Look how his head..." it does eventually make it to Jerusalem. It is believed it doesn't actually make it to Jerusalem until David is king, which means he carries the skull with him amongst his own stuff as a souvenir. Most of Goliath's tools or his weapons also are, although it says here he puts them in David's tent, and he does for a brief period of time, they are also kept as souvenirs, though not by David, by others amongst the country who keep them as, "Wow, look how large this thing once was."
42nd verse says that, "For he was but a youth and ruddy, with
yes.
a handsome appearance." What that ruddy means, I'm not...
You know, I meant to look that up for sure. I've always looked... Does anybody have a computer on them? What was that? Rough-looking? Roughly very rough.
Through the cactus, you know, the very tough.
I think that verse 42, I think it was. Rough-looking. red as far as dark red colored. I imagine it had probably something to do with earth or ground. That's the whole point. The whole area there was supposedly, if the dirt was red, probably a connection there. But also, that's true, it would also make you red.
Trying to visualize what kind of man can take with bare hands lion and bear. So at least he must have a
fairly large man.
fear spirit and coordination and unwavering heart that he is winner.
That's very true. Now, also keep in mind, don't think of bears like, you know, grizzly bears that we have in North America. Those are extremely large bears. But yes, it does require a certain amount of belief and trust. Chutzpah, yes, a bit of nerve. To go ahead and confidently, it, of course, the way he's relaying the story is he goes along there and he says, well, see, I went to save the sheep, pull the sheep out, but when the animal turns on me as if he hadn't done anything to the animal at all yet. He just went over there, grabbed the sheep and took it away, which I think that's highly unlikely. When the animal turns on him is when he then kills the animal. It's an interesting account of how that could have occurred. We don't know for sure. It does not appear that he would have used too many tools. He may have had a knife on him, most likely, or something like that. But it would have been a very interesting battle to watch.
I was just going to say that whether it was a large bear or even something like
a
raccoon,
a
you don't want to mess with a raccoon. They have claws like bears.
Yes. Yeah, bears are still fairly aggressive, as well as, of course, lions. Now, in the Middle Eastern area, lion size is guesstimates as far as what size lion it may or may not have been. Some have argued it's African lion, which are extremely large. Some have argued, well, but more like a much smaller version of lion, long since extinct. And there are a lot of different cats in that area that are fairly good sized. So no one knows what type. But either way, personally, if I was up front against any type of bear or lion, I would probably go the other direction. And let you know, if I could, yeah, assuming I'd get away. If it had a sheep, yeah, I'm sorry, sheep, I'll pray for you and leave. But I'm more of a coward in my own personal nature. Yes, Pat.
I think it's interesting just because of the study earlier. Here again is God's choice. This was the eighth son, not the first son.
Yes.
And God, again, is choosing by the heart of the man and not by the birthright.
Very true. David's selection was, of course, as we recall, was a very interesting process. As Samuel was going through each son, he first thought Eliab was obviously king because he appeared kingly, much like Saul appeared kingly. And God said, no, this is not the right man. You've been looking. You already chose the one that looked right. Now we're chosen the one who actually is right. Yes, Kat.
We also have the sibling rivalry element and how he was the youngest. And we all know how nice older brothers, especially that many older brothers, can be to their younger brother.
To the younger brother.
So he was probably just.
I'm sure he got a. Yeah,
survival,
I'm sure he probably
sake.
Was. Yeah, I'm sure he was. To have seven older brothers and him being the one anointed king would probably bring in quite a bit of a physical abuse as well as some verbal ridicule. Yes.
It's interesting to see how man who in natural was least counted was actually who had the capabilities
important.
To do it. And what I see, it's his spirit, which was so unwavering, and he had the gift of zeal, probably.
Yes. He did. It's something that quite clearly at least his three older brothers did not have. Note that they're at the battle for these 40 days, and we don't know how long. They may have been in Saul's army for a long period of time, at least in this particular battle for 40 days. None of them volunteered to go forth to fight Goliath. None of them had that charisma, that fearlessness, that trust in God, as David did. God chose wisely.
I went to Israel, and our guide told us an interesting tidbit that Oprah and Ruth were the great-grandparents
right.
of both of these men.
Of both Goliath as well as David?
Right. Ophrah was Goliath's great-grandmother, and
Ruth, of course, was for David. I was unaware that there was any connection to Ophrah and Goliath at all. That's interesting.
And also, the extra stones that he picked up
were
for the brothers of Goliath. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that they were potentially for brothers as well. I don't know if there's any truth to it. Who knows? There's a lot of different rumors that fly around. So I have heard arguments that, well, he picked up a stone for each of the individuals that Goliath was insulting. He was insulting, of course, Moses and Aaron. He was insulting, of course, the king. He was insulting, of course, now, funny map here. He insulted the three patriarchs. No, that's six, by the way, not five. He insulted, who's the last one? Oh, Phineas. Jewish tradition, go figure. They somehow figure he insulted seven people, thus he gets five stones. I don't understand that yet. But traditions are traditions. Some have truth, some may or may not. We don't know. But it's possible. I don't know. It'd be interesting if it was the case. We do not know how many brothers Goliath did or didn't have. We do know that there are others in the region that are fairly large-sized individuals. We don't know the exact height, per se, but because we've had Caleb, who, of course, is 400 years earlier, had killed, about 400, 300-something years earlier, had killed a number of giants in what we call today Hebron. So clearly there were a few that were hanging around. Goliath's size we'll get to shortly because there's two different measurements. I'm not quite sure which one's correct. Yes, Hector?
Yeah, I was just noticing the striking parallel between Joseph and his brothers and how he became king in Egypt and now David and his brothers,
how they treat him.
How they treat him. He's also becomes king. Also, he's, being the eighth son, as Christ was resurrected on the eighth day. And I understand that even the name Jesus adds up to eight. I don't know how they do that. I just wonder if everybody knows about that. I don't know if it's in Hebrew Yeshua or in the Greek.
I'm not
Jesus.
Sure. I'd have to look at that.
But of course, eight standing for the number of new beginnings.
Right. It is. And that's one of the reasons I think why God chose him. It was so perfectly selected. He had intended probably all along. That's just the nature of God. Raymond.
It's described many times here that Saul and his men were fear gripped. And the fear is a spirit which is contagious also.
Yes.
But that didn't catch David's heart. David was independent from that fear. And he was just like in home with this situation and totally different than others.
I think that is very well put. One of the unique things which we're going to get to in the short period of time I have left, the 40 days of Goliath testing Israel and what effect it has, not only on Saul, but of course his men, of course all of Israel, and how they react to it. 40 days is not an arbitrary number. It means something. To have been tested for 40 days is they're actually physically being tested, not by Goliath, but by God. Hector.
I'm sorry, I also meant to say, also this is also where we see the idea of the covenant also being fulfilled for us when he slays Goliath as an example of it. As the idea of representative, where all of Israel was victorious in the victory of David.
Yes.
So all of Israel won because of the act of the one man.
Yes.
Likewise with us also in our salvation, that we have our representative who conquers sin and death for us.
Yes. David is a messianic figure. By all accounts, he is. He's not the Messiah, of course, but he is a type of personality, type of person whom God is showing and displaying to all of Israel. Well, this is the kind of person I'm going to bring forth for you that Moses had told you about. Get to know him. Get to familiarize yourself with him because he's going to affect your entire future. Hence, he has all the psalms he wrote, which does affect us. And affected, of course, how the Messiah and how he lived his life and how we recognize various aspects of David and what David does through his life and compare them to what the Messiah does with his life. There are actually a lot of similarities and a lot of hints that we'll see as we go through David's existence. Yes, Raymond.
The Philistines, they offered themselves to be servants for Israel.
Right.
If Goliath is killed.
Correct.
But they fled
Yes.
What that tells us.
Nobody's necessarily good on their word, I should say. Men are men. They still have a tendency to do things that are not necessarily fair or right. I'm going to try to get through this. I know this is a very long chapter. There's a high chance I won't get through the end of it, but we'll just see. I'll read it again next time. With another quick questions, I'm going to go through a few of these points, because I think I want to get to one that's fairly important. At least I believe it's fairly important. Okay, David's still relatively young. What's his exact age? We don't really know, but he's probably late teens, early 20s when this occurs. Which will lead into why Saul doesn't necessarily recognize him again. When it first describes Goliath, this is all of your Bibles, I'm sure, translated as says, verse 4, a champion goes forth from the Philistine camp. They didn't even say anything other than a champion. There's a really high chance he does say anything but a champion, but that's, I'm just curious. Does anybody actually have what it really says? It says a man in the middle. And a man in the middle goes forth in Philistine camp. Okay, a man in the middle. What is that? Okay, what's the significance of a man in the middle? Well, you can look at it very, very physically. Well, yes, see, there's one camp on one side, one camp on the other side. A man goes in the middle, right? Simple. But man in the middle actually has other aspects to it. This is why your Bibles translate it as a champion. Aaron was the man in the middle. He was a man in the middle. When he goes through the midst of the play with the incense of various things he is a man in the middle, the one who is between life and death. It is a fairly difficult place to stand. It is. So Philistines have a man in the middle. It means one who is willing to go forth between life and death and stand and say, bring it on. Is it a champion? He may or may not be. I don't know how many people he has or has not killed. But he obviously has the courage and the ability to stand there confidently that he will survive. Yes, Jeff.
It's a very ancient battle strategy that you stick your heaviest, your most powerful stuff right in the middle to punch through the line, to split the army in two, so then you break through and divide both sides and conquer them.
Yes, fairly effective. I believe Alexander the Great then changed that strategy. He found that it was best to put his strongest guys against the opponent's weakest end. Hence, he was able to conquer such huge swaths of land in such a short lifespan. But yes, at that time it was strongest against strongest to punch through was the idea, divide and conquer concept, which sounds good, but they've learned worked better if you just conquered without dividing. But we'll discuss that when we get to a few more battles that David does in his near future. So, man's willing to stand up between life and death, Goliath. Now it says he's six cubits and a hand breadth, I believe, is the proper discussion. Let's see, a hand span. Height 6 cubits and 1 hand or 1 span. It's been debatable. Is it 18 inches? No one really knows. Is it 20 inches? Well, some arguments say it actually is closer to 20 versus 18. It doesn't really matter. The point is he was either 9.5 feet or 13 feet. Whether a man is 9.5 or 13, he's still a very large man. To me personally, it's probably somewhere between that range due to the fact that his spear is a weaver's beam, which I don't know if you've seen a weaver's beam. I saw one when I was a little kid. It's a fairly good sized beam. You don't grasp that with a single hand very easily. And that's a whole spear. You know, you throw them. Not an easy task to do. So he's a fairly large individual, which also means, because traditionally a sword was approximately half of your body height. How long was the sword that David used to cut his head off? 4 to 5 foot long sword. Now David, of course, then uses that sword, not at this point in time, but later on when he's fleeing from Saul, and it becomes his own personal sword. That means David's a fairly strong, good-sized individual to be able to wield a 4 to 5 foot long sword. I mean, personally, that's most of my height. I'm only a little over 6 feet, so I'm like a foot shorter than my height. That's a pretty good sized sword. Now, not to say that David was, you know, 9 feet tall. No, 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 nothing, of course. But strong enough to use it, and use it to actually effectively kill someone or something, that takes a pretty good-sized person and strength to do so. Yes, I'm sure he has armor bearer. Hey, you lug this up the hill, I'll meet you on the other side. Goliath's fairly good size. Of course, his armor, very heavy armor. Now, I'm sure some of you have noticed it points out his armor is measured in copper shekels versus his spear is measured in iron shekels. Well, we always think a shekel is a measure of weight. Well, it's sort of a measure of weight, meaning a silver shekel has a certain weight and size, but iron and copper are based on their size. They are to match the size of the silver shekel, not necessarily the weight of the silver. Obviously, iron weighs more than silver, in case you weren't aware of that. It weighs, well, that's pretty close, actually, not that far off. Copper weighs, they have slightly different measurements of weight, but their size was relative to the silver shekel, which had weight and size. It's a little confusing there. But approximately 250 or so pounds worth of mail on him, not including his other shields and his helmet. 250 some odd pounds. That's a lot. I mean, I don't know how many are familiar with weights, but that's a lot of weight. that's definitely more than one of me, one and a half, one and three quarters, whatever, of just the armor that is on him. Not, you know, his tools, not anything else. Of course, it's probably why he has someone carrying his shield for him. I wouldn't blame him with that much weight. I would want someone else to carry it as well. So he has a shield carrier. Fairly good-sized man, of course. And, of course, David has to go forth. Note, there are two Philistines in the battle. We think of Goliath and David, right? Well, there's actually Goliath and his shield-bearer are both on the battle. Shield-bearer is in front of Goliath as he's approaching. Why? Why would he have a shield bearer in front of him while he's approaching the battle line? Carrying the shield, why not be on his side? Why not be on behind him? Any comments or... Hold on a minute.
So that the person could shield him from whatever David tries to defeat him with.
Yes. But not necessarily David. You're right. He does shield himself with something. What does he shield himself from? Is it rocks? No. Arrows. Keep in mind that the Israelite army, yes, they had, the shepherds had slings and such, but arrows were long since invented before this. They have bows and arrows. They can shoot him from a distance. We could have killed him, right? Shoot an arrow, I'll fight you, I'll stand, you know, oh, give me like 50 yards. Okay, now I'll get you. That kind of thing. Anybody could have killed Goliath with an arrow, but not with the shield bearer in front of him. It prevents arrows from attacking. Yes, he has mail, he has protective armor, but there are always weak points, which David, of course, found one on his face. But he has shield bearer in front of him to prevent from arrows from attacking while he's challenging. Raymond, I believe you. Oh. Same thing. Okay.
Well, you know, something else is that yes. The shield does have the emblem.
That's true, it does.
So going before him is like a flag.
To identify who he is. Which I want to get to this. This is interesting. Goliath, verse 8, calls himself the Philistine. Didn't even notice that. I didn't say I am a Philistine. I am the Philistine. Why is he taking credit for all the army, the whole camp? Is that he is the one and only? What was that?
The one that came forth.
Only one that came forth? Yes, he is the only one who came forth. We, and myself primarily included, so I include myself at least in this, think of the word Philistine as a group of people. Like, I am this group of people. Well, yes, but that's not what the Hebrew word Philistine means. Yes, Jeff.
He was the invader.
Correct. Philistine is singular form for I am the invader. Am I not? So he is saying, am I not the invader? Have I not been? I am not the one who is invading you? Well, we use the term invader, but that can be a single or many people. So use the term I am the Philistine. I am the invader. And of course, he did invade. He's, if you haven't noticed my little map up here, they're in Judah's territory. So yes, he is speaking for, yes, the camp as a whole, but the Hebrew term is, I am the Philistines, I am the invader. Why will you not come out and fight me? Why will you not stop this invasion? So he is correct by using the singular form of I am the Philistine, or I'm not the Philistine. I find that interesting because it's just, not everybody realizes the word Philistine means invader. It's a singular form, invader. So he calls upon all Israelites and he calls them slaves of Saul. Let's see. It says, am I not the Philistine? Why, while you are the slaves, or some interpret the word servants, but it's slaves is equally correct, slaves of Saul. Choose yourself a man and come down to me. Slaves of Saul. How many people did he insult when he says the slaves of Saul? And who did he insult? His army. He insulted who else? Well, define everybody. Yes, but in particular, he insults Saul, but God himself. That's an insult to God. You are slaves of this man, Israel, not you are slaves of your God, you are slaves of this man. That one statement alone is insulting God. Very bold statement to say. Which, of course, is why it says he blasphemes and he's doing these various things and insults and challenges all of Israel, disgraces them. So basically, he challenges, give me a fighter, give me someone to attack. And, of course, then verse 12 shows up and David arises and we're introduced again. Reintroduced to David. Now, we've already been introduced to David the previous chapter. So why are we being reintroduced to him again in this chapter? Do we not already know who David is? This has to do with a little bit as to why Saul didn't necessarily recognize David in the end of the chapter. In case you were all unaware of, which I was unaware of until a few years ago, our Bible was not written chronologically. It does not start from beginning, although it does say in the beginning, don't get me wrong, and does not go from sequential event to event to event to event to event. It doesn't work that way. It's not written that way. Why not? Well, because the authors who were writing it were more interested in subject matter than they were sequences of events. They recorded sequences of events in the ages of an individual. If he was so many years old, he begat this person. He reigned for so many years, then he died. Then so and so. That is sequential. But events are not sequential. Correction. Events can be, but subject matters are not sequential. If I choose to talk about the subject matter of faith, just for an example, and I go through the sequential order of Genesis through Revelations, will I talk to you about faith? Yeah, along with a whole lot of other things. It is much easier to go through the subject matter. I will select these 5 or 6 chapters and discuss how faith was applied. See, that is a subject matter as opposed to a sequential event. So this event, when did it occur relative to the time when David is brought forth and becoming his harp player? Possibly. It's possible this is actually prior to this event. But most likely, they're almost simultaneous. Why do I say that? Well, because after this event, the immediately following, Saul knows who David is, knows all the details about him. Well, the previous occurrence that regarding the harpist, Saul knows very little about David. Yes, he knows that he is the son of Jesse and he has some brothers. Well, if I am king, how much do I know about all my servants? Well, think about it. Let's say we have a queen of England, right? Well, we don't personally, but there is a queen of England. All of her servants, everybody who serves her, how much does she know about each one of them? I doubt she knows half their names. Why? Because it's not important to know them all, to know all their details, their detail matters. So when David was brought forth to come to Saul and play for him, Does Saul know or remember every detail regarding David? Not likely. Would he recognize what he looked like? Maybe. I say maybe because how much detail is a king going to give to a harpist on what they appear to be? Versus right now, David, by the way, is dressed up as a shepherd, in case you were unaware of that. Saul is not necessarily forgetting who David was. He might not recognize him, in spite of the fact they're very close or relatively close events. I say they're relatively close because David still here is called relatively young, the youth or late teens, early 20s, which is the same time which he was brought before Saul as late teens. So within, I'm guessing, about a year, maybe 2 years, this event occurs. Before or after is debatable, but it does occur. We also have our Bibles written from multiple different perspectives. The people from the group A over here recall certain amounts of details about a person or individual, i.e. the story of how David met Saul by killing Goliath. And the group over here, B, says, well, yeah, but David met Saul when he was playing the harp because Saul was melancholy, had issues. And then about 600 to 700 years later, another group, C, takes story A and story B and shoves them together back to back. Says, here's your Bible. So, what story is completely correct? What stories have intertwined, mixing? We don't know. So, they probably occurred relatively close to one another. Both of them are probably completely correct, meaning the events themselves. When they occurred or how they intermeshed with one another, we do not know. We don't know how well they intermeshed. We do not know how well Saul and David got along as harpists, how well Saul knew him, whether or not they were actually, David was already a warrior before this, we don't know. But the point is, the stories are probably two different melding stories brought together, which is very, 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 very common throughout our entire Bible, so it happens in almost every chapter, is different stories brought together. It's easily demonstrated, but we won't get into that today. Okay. I'm going to have to get through this a little bit faster than I've been going. I apologize for those of you who are more interested in some of the story. David goes to front lines. He brings all this various, the accoutrement, the bread, the cheeses. Why did he bring a cheese to the captain of the thousands, the captain of his brother's army? Well, two different reasons. One, the captain doesn't have to let David to go through. The captain has a family too. And some translations actually specify that he came forth, and it says, to redeem his brother's pledge. As opposed to, your Bible say, to check on their welfare of his brothers, to redeem their pledge. What pledge? Not service pledge. You can't do that, only a king can do that. But you can redeem things you've sold. As a military individual, I don't know how many of you know much about military life, but as a military person, you can sell one of your own personal possessions at this time of day, at this time of year, or in human history. You can sell a personal possession to receive something else. Who do you sell it to? Well, at this time, tradition says you sell it to the guy who is your boss, i.e. the captain of your thousand. Here, captain, I have this gold plate. I need shaving equipment. I use it as an obvious example. I need something that I don't have the ability to go get because we're in the middle of a battle. I can't go to the local hardware store. I can't go to the local supermarket. I need certain items. Will you please get them for me? Captain says, okay, here's your payment. Thank you. And here's the item which you need. Quartermaster.
Yes.
They're very, very common, very familiar. Yes, Ellie.
What you're saying is it worked like a pawn shop.
Very much so, like a pawn shop. That's a very, very good, accurate description. Very common in all militaries up until modern military started to show up and they had, you know, more strict requirements. But it's very common throughout this time. So what was he possibly redeeming? The stuff his brother sold. Here's some cheese, which is a very nice delicacy, by the way, in case you're not aware of. Here's some cheese. I will now buy these items back. Thank you. Return them to my brothers. Very easily could have been done that way. It's not qualms one way or the other. But of course he's there. This is the 40th day that Philistines come up. And Philistine has come up and said, okay, we'll challenge morning and evening. He challenges them. We talked about this briefly a few moments ago. 40. What does 40 mean? Any volunteers? What is the word? What is the number 40? 40 days, 40 years. What is 40? Why is that used? Testing. What else? Suffering.
Completion.
It was almost like a preparation in many ways. Yes, Hector.
Always seems associated with judgment on earth.
It is associated with a type of judgment in many ways. 40, God uses, and of course in Judaism it's very, very big to use this, in a time which you test or prepare or go through a trial. At the end of the trial, hopefully, what did you achieve? Victory. You accomplished it, whatever it was. We have 40 days of awe, which you're familiar with about the year that happens before the fall high days. There are sections of 40 days that Messiah tests for how long? 40 days. It pops up. Say it again.
Rain
40 days. 40 days, 40 comes up very frequently. It's a time which God is the one who uses it, by the way, in case you hadn't just noticed that. All the examples we just cited, those are God examples. He is the one using the 40 days, not some man. So when the Philistine comes up and he challenges him for 40 days, who is being tested? All of Israel is being tested, but who in particular of Israel is being tested? Saul and his sons, Jonathan, and whatever else sons are there. Because Jonathan could have said, I will go fight him. Any one of them could have said, I will go fight them. But as we mentioned previously was brought up, fear. Fear was brought before them, and that was contagious. They looked at what? What were they looking at? What was Saul, Jonathan, all of Israel looking at when they saw Goliath? Size. How big he was. How many weapons he has. One single blow would likely kill anybody. That's all they saw. So their test was based on what they saw. They saw Goliath. Did they pass their test? No, not one stood up and said, I will fight. Not one stood up, I will do it in spite of what it looks like. At the 40-day mark, when it was all said and done, every Israelite, the kings and the king's sons, all failed God's test. And thus God brought forth the one, or a one, who would not fail the test. The 40 days have come. We don't know whether this is the morning of the 40th day, the evening of the 40th day. We don't really know for sure, but it's the 40th day most likely. It could be the 41st, technically, but we're arguing for now, for the sake of this argument, 40th day. All of Israel has failed it. David comes up. He's the only one that passes. The test of all of Israel, God's testing all the men, and guess what? Every single one fails. So I will choose one that is not going to fail. It's the opportunity for David to come forth and say, I will go forth. I will do it. In spite of what it looks like. Oh, hold on. Hector.
Yeah, which is pretty much going to touch what you just touched on. But the messianic figure comes on board, and he gains the victory. And I think it's pointing to the 40 days in the wilderness of our Lord Jesus when he got the victory. Everything is pointing to him.
Exactly. Yeah. Perfectly done. So at the end of the 40 days, Messiah was done. He was ready. He was tested. He proved out. And he passed.
He didn't complete 40.
Yes. Well, yes. He did all 40. Yes. Yes, Raymond.
David uses, or can we say, discovers a symmetric strategy here. He don't go against the strong man with the same class or warfare. Mm-hmm. He takes completely different, which has a different advantage point. And he's a strategist already in this point.
He is a strategist. Actually, he's just a strategist a little bit before this, too. Before he actually faces Goliath, we see a strategy of him. When Eliab gets angry with him, what's he getting angry at? I don't recall. David's going around, he's talking to people, he's saying, oh, who's this Philistine? He's a nobody. Talking smack about the guy. And Eliab, what is Eliab angry about? David's pride, that's one thing, but what's Eliab as the oldest son, primary responsibility? Take care of his younger brothers. Eliab's anger is not necessarily an unrighteous anger. Not necessarily. It could be, but it's not necessarily. As the oldest brother, his job is to protect his younger one. That includes David. If David starts mouthing off, he could easily be the one that's going up to Goliath, and Eliab doesn't want that. It's not. It's his job to protect him. So he's right to be angry, upset, keep your mouth shut, go away, quit this, knock it off, because word's going to get to Saul, and guess what? Word did get to Saul, because David wanted it to. David strategized. He went around, he talked to each of these various groups of people. He didn't go, I want to go see Saul. He said, hey, yeah, I can take this on. I can do this. Talk, and this guy over here, I can do this. This guy over here, I can do this. Until word finally gets around. Then Saul summons David, which is a perfect strategy. Better than saying, I want to go see Saul. Because I want to go see Saul. Saul's busy. Go away, kid. I mean, honestly, if I was king, I'm busy. Go away, kid. Go away. I'm busy. A lot of things to do. As opposed to, I want to speak to him. Much better place to be.
Going back to the 40 days and the 40 years of Israel and their lack of faith, and this is Israel, again, lack of faith.
It is.
And
it
David
is. Yep.
Having the faith.
And David identifies what the cause of their lack of faith is. As he points out, when he starts talking, jump a little bit here, he starts talking when he approaches Goliath, and they start talking back and forth, you know, cursing each other's gods, that kind of thing. Let's see, verse, just lost it here. Next page, that's why. Verse 47, and all this assembly will know that not, this is verse David speaking to Goliath, that not through sword and spear does the Lord grant salvation. For unto the Lord is the battle, and he shall deliver you into our hands. He's identifying that it's not through the sword. Yes, you brought your javelin. Yes, you brought your spears, your armor. You brought all your tools to come to battle. But that's not how God saves. That's not how God deals with people. And he yells it loud enough for the Philistines to hear it from a slight distance. So I imagine all of Israel heard it, or those nearby would have heard the same words out of David's mouth. That's not how God judges. It's not how God chooses who wins and who loses. It's not through those tools. That moment of testing, that moment of time, of lack of faith, it's because Israel and Saul, Jonathan, all of them put their faith in what they saw. Yes, Jeff.
And is that why the Philistine army fled? Because when David took him out so easily, after saying that, I mean, you have to wonder if they got the idea that their gods could not
their
compete.
Their gods could not do it. Now, Philistines had that problem only a few years before this. Those who recall with the Ark of the Covenant being brought over to Philistines and the rats and the tumors and whatever else and the hemorrhoids and all that kind of stuff. They had that problem. They identified, okay, this is a much stronger God than ours. Get him out of here. So now they're running across it all over again. We already know this God's strong. Run. That's just exactly what they saw. They saw an individual that should have won, by all accounts, any battle against any man, and was killed by a youth, an unprotected youth. Note that David had so much nerve, chutzpah, belief in God, that the armor wasn't there, swords weren't there, spear wasn't there, nothing was there. He didn't have anything. He had a stick, a staff. And a little sling and a few stones. Of course, Philistine didn't see the sling and stones, did he? No, because the Philistine's response when he sees David is, am I a dog? You're using a stick? Because he sees the staff, assuming that's the tool David's going to use to fight him with. A stick, okay, bring the stick on. Unaware of what actual tools a shepherd uses, or at least he personally was not thinking he was vulnerable to such tools, as we have discussed in the past, an experienced, full-sized male shepherd who has done this in the past can throw a stone of a sling, roughly a 4-ounce sling, upwards of 140 to 150 miles an hour. That's going to hurt. It has been known to kill on impact, depending on where it actually hits you. It hits you on the shoulder, you're not likely to die. Clearly in Goliath's case, hits you right in the forehead, you're probably not going to live. Yes, Carrie.
It just brings to mind Proverbs 16:18, pride comes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall.
Very true. Very true. It is true. Because Goliath saw with his eyes and not thinking about what would actually happen, what could actually happen with this God that he has been insulting this whole time, for these 40 days, he did have pride. He saw exactly what God wanted him to see. He wanted him to see the stick. So that's all he saw. Could the shield armor bearer could have raised the shield up to protect Goliath's face? Probably. What was the shield bearer looking at also? Most likely, the stick. He probably set his shield down. Said, okay, bring it on. There's nothing to hurt us with a stick. Now, I find it's interesting, this is my personal opinion, thoughts interjected here. The armor bearers for Saul and Jonathan, what were their tasks? We discussed this last week, or 2 weeks ago. The tasks were sparring partners. You fought along with your partner to train them and get them better. Notice that Goliath's armor bearer didn't. He didn't bring out his own little sword and start attacking David. Unlike Jonathan's armor bearer who did. Unlike Saul's armor bearer who actually does when before Saul dies. They actually fought. Well, in Goliath's case, there was no armor bearer. He didn't fight. Why? He was probably so thoroughly shocked that he ran like all the rest of the Philistine camp.
Left that big new shield.
Besides, if I was an armor bearer, I do not want to be the sparring partner of Goliath. I don't know about you, but a single impact from a man that large, I don't care what I've got. I don't want to be his sparring partner. I'm not likely to survive it. He probably went through quite a few armor bearers before the last one finally figured it out. Don't fight this guy. Don't bother trying to train him. It's not worth it. But that's my own personal opinion interjected there. So of course, David throws his rock. It penetrates his skull. Now, of course, my Bible reads that it kills Goliath when he falls to the ground. Of course, some of your Bibles say, well, he goes over and cuts his head off to make sure Goliath's dead, or to kills him for sure. Whichever one actually killed him, whether it was a stone that killed him or the sword that killed him, doesn't really matter. The point is Goliath's dead, and he died rather simply with the first shot. So, of course, this is the point which I think David realizes, stop. Stop. Don't go any further. When God grants a miracle in my life, your life, whatever, or grants a wish, grants something that we normally wouldn't get or wouldn't have happened to us, a benefit, how do you know when not to push it? How do you know when not to push it? Not to push further, not to go beyond? Exactly. David didn't go fight the army. Once God grants the miracle, David stopped. He didn't go with all of Israel and go attack. Why not? Say it again, a little louder.
A check in his spirit.
Told him not to. Wanted a souvenir. He'd have to set Goliath's head down to go fight. Yes, Kathy.
I think it's a gratitude.
A point to which he realizes that God has done something miraculous for him. It is. It is a point. But I find it interesting because it shows the character of David a little bit. Because had David gone through and continued and fought along with the Philistines, would that add anything to the God's miracle? Would that assist or praise God in any way, shape, or form? Not really, because it wouldn't be recorded. You know, so he went off and fought. It wouldn't have said how many people he killed, wouldn't say if he got injured, nothing of the sort. Well, David went forth to the Philistine with no armor, no protection, no weapons to speak of. He asked for a miracle because he believed in God, and God granted it to him. But God wasn't necessarily going to give him a miracle of go ahead and go fight now also, because David is unprotected and unarmed. No, David's not a warrior trained in battle. Close hand-to-hand combat clearly is not his forte. He didn't do it. Well, lions and bears are different. They don't have swords on their hands, and they're actually doing like close hand-to-hand combat. They have teeth, they have claws, don't get me wrong. But there are different ways which an animal fights versus a man fights. David knew his limitation. He knew what God was going to grant. And at that moment, after Goliath died, head was cut off, he didn't go to battle. He was done and he knew it. So he stopped. It's a moment which I believe David realized God granted him a wonderful blessing. Don't stress or don't test God any further. Would God have protected David had he gone to battle? Most likely. Would David have gotten injured? Maybe. He'd probably been fine, though. He could have probably done it. But David knew not to test God past that moment. It's a beautiful point, at least I believe. He did. He did. He had the relationship that Saul once had when Saul was first selected, and then Saul lost it. And Jonathan had early on, and he lost it. David didn't lose it, at least not at this point. David's connection with God was so strong enough, that he could identify when God granted a miracle and said, "This is all. We're going to this far, this point, and stop." You notice a very obvious contrast to Saul, who would go so much further. Way beyond what God ever allowed, wanted, or desired. Decreeing his own laws, following thereafter battles, preventing people from eating, doing various rules, fasts of death if you violate them. None of that. David didn't do that. He knew when to stop. Saul didn't. Yes, Kathy.
I'm sure also that David wanted to glorify God, and had he, somebody who pushes things normally is looking for their own glory.
Perfect, yes. David did want to glorify God. I think that's exactly what he was doing. He knew. He knew that this would glorify. This would do it. Do not go further. God doesn't need any excessive glory. He doesn't need to go back to battle, go further, do more. No. None of that's needed. That was all that was needed. Stop. Perfectly done. Let's see. Ellie, you had your hand up a second ago.
Well, I was just going to say that same thing. It was going to become about Saul.
Yes.
Rather than God.
Right. It did
or
become about
David.
Saul. Yeah, it would be about
rather
David
than
then.
God.
Now the next chapter, they start singing David's praises. Oh, he killed these 10,000s and Saul his thousands and blah, blah, blah. David didn't kill 10,000 men. He killed one. But through that single act, tens of thousands died of the Philistines. So in a manner of speaking, he did. But the glory that people put upon him is different than what the glory that God put upon him. Yes.
To think of it this way. You know, David did his job. If I were David, I would be sitting there thinking, at least this would come to my mind at one brief point. I've done the job God gave me to do. Now, finally, y'all, do yours.
I'm sure that's exactly what's going through his head, too. Finally, get a payback to his brothers. All right, guys, you have 40 days. Now it's your turn. That is true. I'm sure that's a factor in what David's thinking. Other than the fact he's completely unarmed, other than Goliath's very large sword, which I don't believe David's very good at wielding at this point in his life yet. Okay. Saul didn't recognize him, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Raymond, you had a hand up?
Man who is in battle has lots of energy and spirit put toward that. And there's that, what's the right word, syndrome, battle after
post-traumatic stress.
Yeah,
right.
And I believe David was so wise to take care of that and relate to God to that healing, because it's a
traumatic
trauma.
Thing to kill a man.
Yeah.
It's a traumatic thing. If those of you who are not aware of that, police officers have issues with it. Killing a human being is not an easy thing to do. And David is supposed to be his first human being killed. Probably was also a very traumatic thing. Now, how traumatic it was for David. I don't think it was terribly traumatic, because, by the way, he did carry around Goliath's head for quite a while, and he used it as a trophy and a souvenir. So though I'm sure it was traumatic to kill a man, not enough to not take the glory for it. See, look what I did. So yes, you're right, and I think David realized his personal limitations. I also believe that somewhere inside of him, God was telling him, enough is enough. This is your point, which you stop. Yes, Carrie.
It just, to me, I see his servant heart. You know, he was very, you know, like we were saying, he was strategic, but he obviously was very aware of the strategy of his God, his commander, because, you know, God strategizes when he does things, especially in battle. And it was a very unique strategy to just do this one man, and then the rest of it was all just fallout.
It is, and of course, and as we see the same strategy that God uses again with the Messiah, and there's one other instance, I believe, if I recall correctly, he uses it again in our Tanakh. God does use that strategy of a single individual. That takes a lot of that one person. Once that one task is completed, everything else falls in place. God plans things out very, very well.